Scientists estimate that more than 10,000 species are going extinct every year.
Here's the male song again. That's the last male of a species singing for a female who will never come.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Academy Award-winning filmmaker and native Iowan Louis Sahoyas about his new documentary, Racing Extinction. The film is designed to be a warning, a call to action, and a message of hope. Then later in the hour, the play Out of Bounds was created to help middle schoolers understand and deal with cyberbullying. This award-winning play is continuing to tour the state. I'll talk with the writer and director. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Louis Sahoyas won an Academy Award back in 2010 for his documentary The Cove about dolphin hunting practices in Japan. He is back with a new documentary, Racing Extinction, about the impact humans are having on the planet right now. He grew up in Dubuque. He's also the founder and executive director of the Oceanic Preservation Society, and he'll be speaking at Iowa State University tonight at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union, and he is with me now. Louis, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In creating this documentary, you tackle really a huge subject, and I can imagine it was probably pretty difficult to try to think about approaching this subject on film. What was the concept that led you to making this documentary?
I did four stories as a still photographer for National Geographic magazine. I wrote a book on paleontology for Random House. And, you know, I'm a paleo geek, and one of my friends is Michael Novacek, who is the provost of the American Museum of Natural History up in New York, and he wrote a book called Terra. And I brought this book with me to Sundance, and in the book he's talking about how we're losing species now faster than mankind's ability to even record that these animals are on the planet with us. And I thought, that's depressing, so I picked up the only other book I brought with me, A Reef in Time, by this guy Charles Verone, the former chief marine scientist for Australia. And in that book, he's talking about how we're losing the Great Barrier Reef and all other reefs on the planet because of acidification. And that always happens right before a mass extinction event, which we're headed for right now. And I thought, I consider myself an amateur paleontologist, but I didn't know that we were in the middle of what scientists are calling the Anthropocene, the age of man. It's an extinction event that a lot of scientists think will rival the one that killed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Well,
so that haunted me, and I thought, well, how can you make a film about it and make it exciting, make it interesting, and give people solutions? So it's not just a simple awareness film, it's a call to action.
And I want to play just a moment from the film that really helps put what you're talking about in perspective. Let's listen.
What we're seeing now is called the Anthropocene, the new epoch. Anthropocene means the time of humans. It's when the impact of humans is leaving itself as a mark in the fossil record of the future. 65 million years ago, there was an asteroid that struck and caused the dinosaurs to go extinct.
When it comes to the sixth extinction event, we have no problem identifying the cause. Humanity has become the asteroid.
That's just a moment from the new documentary, Racing Extinction. And it helps us understand what you're talking about with this sixth great extinction. The idea of making a documentary and trying to show this on film, I mean, it's as you mentioned, it's incredibly depressing subject. But even to try to show this visually, I can imagine, was a tremendous challenge.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing for the last, 40 years. I worked for 20 years for National Geographic magazine doing stories like Sleep and Dreams and The Sense of Smell. How do you illustrate those topics? I was really good at that, the top of my field. And so it was the switch over to film was really just a matter of how do you take these big epic stories I was doing for National Geographic as a still photographer and try to make you know, a 90-minute film that feels like a James Bond film as opposed to a boring documentary that you might see on a science channel. And so that's what we've done. I mean, the film, you know, it's like the Avengers, but it's real. It's we are about to lose the planet at this massive rate. And so the call to action is to get, you know, how do you get the best minds of the world together to try to figure out how can you solve this issue? So we, you know, started calling on people like Elon Musk, who's, you know, built the best rated electric car in the world, or best rated car in the world. And, you know, we started thinking, well, how can we make this an exciting call to action? Because the solutions, you know, are all upgrades. We know that we can beat this thing. We just have to align together as one, as a culture. I mean, we've done this before in the past. We've done it with you know, big issues, World War II. This is the biggest story on the planet. My friends in paleontology say that when we look back at the human experience, let's say the Industrial Revolution to the year 2100, people look back and say World War II will be a footnote compared to our generation presiding over what could be the biggest loss of the species on the planet since, you know, the last extinction. So to me, it's you know, how can you galvanize all these resources? And we do it in the film. The film is any film that you see or book that you read that moves you probably makes you feel sad. You know, there's going to be an act two dip where you feel catastrophic. But, you know, I think the good films, the good books, the good stories, plays, they bring you up higher than they left you. And that's what we intend to do with this film. It's an exciting adventure film, you know, wrapped around this tale of losing species. So, above all, I think the film's a good story. It should be. If you're living on this planet, we should take an interest in this issue, if not this movie.
Well, that premise right there is one that many scientists, many environmentalists have struggled with for a long time. The conversation about climate change, not only has there been a lot of noise from climate change deniers or climate change skeptics, but also the ability to grab the public's attention and actually make them care about climate change. I think a lot of people have been astonished by how difficult that is.
It is difficult, but I think we've broken through that barrier with this film. I mean, I don't want to, you know, have a spoiler alert on your program, but you know, we did an event on the Empire State Building that people said, oh, you know, we did this back on August 1st. And people said, you know, oh, this is in New York City. And they said, you know, everybody's going to be in the Hamptons. The media is not going to be there in a weekend. You're going to do this big event and nobody's going to show up. We stopped traffic on Fifth Avenue. We stopped New Yorkers in their track. We had 939 million media views of this event that we did where we lit up the Empire State Building with endangered species. And we were the top trending story for 4 days running worldwide on Facebook and Twitter. You know, when people tell me that, you know, something can't be done, it's like catnip. You know, I think there's, you know, we're used to thinking of the expert, the pundits as experts, but they're not. They're just people like you and I. And I've learned to not listen to them, you know, to go against the grain and to think unconventionally. And that's what we're doing with this film. I think we've broken through this barrier. I mean, we're doing another projection event that'll make that event look like a warm-up act. I can't talk about it, but it'll happen during COP21. This is when the world leaders are getting together in Paris to sign the Kyoto Protocols. I think, you know, 60% of Republicans believe in climate change. It's just that the ones that are in office are being commandeered by the Tea Party pundits. You know, the world is changing. It's changing very quickly. People understand that climate change is not a hoax. And even if you don't believe in climate change, you can look at the world. You know, the ocean is becoming more acidic. And that's just pure science. I mean, it is with climate change, too. But people can't imagine how you can change the atmosphere. But we're changing. We're even more scary is we're changing the oceans. The oceans, you know, they control climate. They control, you know, 2 out of every 3 breaths that you take are created by plankton. You know, far more oxygen is created than plankton and animals that you can't see, but then by all the land forests and all the world. And that's what's scary, because all these, you know, the plankton has a carbonic shell and that's starting to dissolve. And that's because of, you know, carbonic acid from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere gets absorbed by the oceans. And it's we're changing the chemistry of the oceans. This is huge stuff. And if we don't do something about it, and this generation start to do something about it, the next generation will be too late to fix it. And that to me is doesn't make me feel despondent. It makes me feel emboldened. You know, it's like we're the only generation that can fix it. So, you know, we have to get off our butts and do something about it.
As in the documentary, you bring together a number of many different pieces of this puzzle to demonstrate the changes you were just talking about, the changing chemistry of the ocean water. And you have a couple of different examples that really illustrate that. You also, as you did in the Cove, you focus on some of the behaviors that humans continue to pursue that really damage endangered species even further. And many of the places that you go, many of the people that you profile who are harvesting endangered species and putting species at risk through their hunting practices, many of them are in China. Can you paint for us a little bit of a picture of what you found as you went looking for this?
Well, the you know, you expect that the endangered species trade would be really underground. And in China, a lot of it is just right on the surface. I mean, you can buy, you know, carved elephant tusks at, you know, there's a whole shopping district for this. And these are, you know, tusks that come in illegally, and then they're masked as being, you know, old, or, you know, they're being, you know, the documentation is being forged, so they look like they're old. And they're being carved from modern elephants, and they're being sold for, you know, trinkets, for trophies, really. And it's everywhere. It's just rampant. The whole, and it's not just elephant tusks. It's, you know, rhino horn. It's manta gills. It's, you know, just about everything you can imagine is for sale in some of these markets. And some of it, you know, some of the markets are illegal. There's one in Guangzhou, China, that we went to, and it operates only in the middle of the night, like from 3 in the morning till 6 in the morning. Then it turns into like a farm market. So imagine like a farmer's market where they're selling, you know, regular animals, let's say, instead of, you know, peaches and oranges and, you know, corn. They're selling at the back doors. They're selling, you know, elephant tusks, manta gills, you know, all sorts of endangered species out of the back rooms. And that was just terrifying. And you see, first of all, you hear the screams of the animals in these cages that they're all. And then, but when we're walking down the street, you know, we're not in, you know, we look different than everybody else. We're, you know, half a foot taller than everybody, and we're, you know, white people in a Asian market. And the doors to all these shops, these steel doors, start to close down. The lights of this village start to systematically, you know, go out ahead of us as people learn that we're in town. And literally this whole neighborhood about the size of Chelsea would just turn off all their lights as we're coming down the street.
I'm talking with Luis Cejuelas, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me is Luis Cejuelas. He won an Academy Award for his documentary, The Cove, in 2010, about dolphin hunting practices in Japan. He's done a great deal of work as an environmentalist, as a photographer and a filmmaker. He is the founder and executive director of the Oceanic Preservation Society, and he has a new documentary called Racing Extinction, about the time that we are living in on our planet right now and the damage that the human race is doing to the co-inhabitants of our planet. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University tonight at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. And Louis, before the break, we were talking about some of the illegal trade in endangered species that you were able to film in China. And one of the very important points that you make in the film is, okay, as Westerners, it's really easy for us to look at some of these practices that are going on in China right now and condemn them. But at the same time, we need to understand our role in what's going on there and how we have interacted with the planet as well. What do you think we need to take away from that as Westerners?
Well, first of all, you know, the United States is the second biggest importer of endangered species on the planet. So, I mean, the problem isn't just in China. The problem is here in America, too. And, you know, we're working with an organization called Vulcan Productions. This is Paul Allen's group. He's the co-founder of Microsoft. You know, he's working to solve big picture stories like this one. And we're working with initiatives in all the port states like Washington State, Oregon State, California, to try to close down these loopholes for trading endangered species. Well, like, for instance, it might be illegal in Washington State to trade in shark fins, but you can bring in a container of shark fins as long as it's not open there and have it transferred to Chicago. So we're working with them with trying to get an amendment passed. It's called 1401 in Washington State. We're working with all the port states, working with this initiative, because the country is so polarized on these issues, but it's much easier to get it done statewide. So that's what we're doing. We're, you know, my organization is not just we don't just make films. So I tell the crew, we're not making movies, we're starting movements. So like The Cove, the first movie I worked on, we still have a team of people working on that issue today. And we'll be working on this issue, you know, hopefully for the next 5-10 years. The idea of a nonprofit organization is you're always trying to put yourself out of business, you know, by solving the issue. But unfortunately, I think this one has a pretty long shelf life, because it's going to take a long time before people really understand what's at stake here. But that's why we make films. I mean, you know, this film is going to be broadcast on the Discovery Channel on December 2nd, and they're going to be doing something unprecedented in television history. They're going to do a network-wide release of the film on the same day, so that when the sun comes up in New Zealand, it'll start to be shown on the Discovery Channel, Animal Planet, and Science, and it'll be like the ball dropping on New Year's Eve. It'll end up 24 hours later in California, where the film gets shown. And the idea is they're trying to get 1 billion people to see this film over the course of a few weeks. So, you know, I think we can get to that point with the numbers, if enough people see the film, that we can create this tipping point. You know, Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote the book called Tipping Point, said you need about 16% of the population to have an unwavering belief in the truth, and then the rest of the population follows. And, you know, if you get the early adopters, the people, the change makers, you know, involved in the issue, then the rest of the society follows suit. And that's what we're trying to do with this film, trying to get as many people as possible so we can hit that 10% tipping point and start to move things around.
And in so many ways, you attempt to really bring home the message of our own personal responsibility for what's going on in the planet right now. And I want to play another clip from the film.
It sounds a bit silly, change your diet and save the planet, but if humans could become vegetarians now, you would make a massive difference.
By far and away, the biggest factor in terms of this mass extinction is destroying natural habitat or converting natural habitat into land for food.
That's another moment from the new documentary from Luis Sahoya's Racing Extinction. And as a man who grew up in Dubuque, Iowa, you can understand where that message is going to be controversial in the state of Iowa, in the Midwest, but really all over the United States and in many other places around the world. And you really paint a picture of the kind of pollution and damage that we cause, not just with habitat loss, but methane production. Is this a subject that you really think that environmentalists can take on and make an impact with?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the raising of meat for human consumption causes more greenhouse gases than the entire emissions from all the transportation sector. You know, that means that, you know, a vegan driving a Hummer uses less energy than a meat eater on a bicycle. You know, if you want to change the world, I mean, you can start doing it 3 times a day by adopting more of a plant-based diet. We're not suggesting that everybody turns into a vegetarian or a vegan overnight, but, you know, certainly adopting a meatless Monday like we're doing in school systems is within the realm of possibility. I mean, it's when you look at the exchange of energy to raise an animal to eat it, It's the craziest amount of energy. If you were the movie that's playing right now about, you know, Brad Pitt on Mars, or was it
Matt Damon on Mars?
Matt Damon, yeah,
close enough.
Matt Damon gave me the Academy Award. I should remember that. but I mean, you would if you were on Mars, you wouldn't raise an animal to eat it. You would eat the plants that it eats. But we're not doing that in this because we have endless amounts of land. But all the protein, all the nutrition that you get from that animal originally comes from plants. All you're doing when you eat an animal is mugging it for its nutritional value that it got from plants. So, if you want to save the planet, you have to adopt more of a plant-based diet. That's just sort of the ante. You know, well, another thing that we did at my organization, OPS, the Oceanic Preservation Society, is we installed solar panels, 120 solar panels on the roof. We generated 140% of our energy, from our roof. We made the last film on solar power. And, I've been driving electric cars since 2007. This is a fully electric, it's not a Tesla, it's an old, 13-year-old Toyota RAV, fully electric car, and I charge it with the sun. The license plate says VUS, it stands for Vehicle Using Sun. It's the opposite of an SUV. I don't pay for electricity or gasoline, when I'm at home. It's just, to me, it's kind of a thing of the past. The great thing about electric cars is nothing ever goes wrong with them. The 12 years that car has been around, it's never, ever been in the shop for anything. So, because there's one moving part in the engine, the rotor, nothing goes wrong with it. And I think the car companies know this. That's why they're scared of them, is because, there's nothing. They make most of their money on repairs. And when you have an electric car, very little goes wrong.
Well, you spend a little bit of time, so many people, when they read about environmental challenges or climate change, things like that, and they think, well, they feel powerless. And in talking about changing one's diet, you also look at some of the other things, the other behaviors that we have as humans that have a big impact on the planet. You look at filmmaking, which is not the most environmentally friendly activity of all. But when you want people to have a takeaway message, obviously you are trying to get people to act and to change their behaviors. Is that diet change, do you feel like that is the most effective way that people can change their behaviors?
Yeah, it's far more effective than buying a Prius or even an electric car. Diet is definitely one of the way forward, but certainly just looking at your energy consumption and changing it. Iowa is a great case in point. There's a lot of sunshine there. I know that it's been a long time since I've been home, but I know you guys are doing great things with wind. Looking at these alternative smart energy choices, it's the way of the future. And we're just getting – it's happening. It's happening already. The fossil fuel companies are very scared. They know what's coming. That's why they're trying to erase the incentives. They're trying to block whatever they can because they know they have a dying business, that their years are limited, and they want to protect their investment. But it's happening. We're going to switch over in time. And I think in 50 years, if somebody has a fossil fuel driving car, people look at it like somebody's, a car going down the street with an internal combustion engine. It'll be like somebody smoking in a restaurant. They just won't do it. The issue is, can we scale it up fast enough? That's what I want to do. I'm trying to, push this curve so it happens a lot quicker than you would normally do. I'm telling you, a film is a very, very powerful tool. I call it a weapon of mass construction. You drop a bomb, you kill people. But if you make a film, you create allies. And if we can get a billion people to see this film, or even a big percentage of that, we can, start to get to this point where we create where things start to move, to evolve quicker. I know it can happen. The first story I did for National Geographic was a story on garbage and recycling. This is back in 1980. There's only one mandatory recycling program in all of America. We did that story. About 44 million people saw it. 44 million Americans saw it. And we started a conversation that, why are we throwing away these things that, last eternally, like aluminum cans, and using for a single use and throwing them away? But now, I'm at a hotel here in New York City. There's recycling underneath the desk. There's recycling everywhere. It's kind of, it'd be strange to be throwing out bottles and cans without recycling them. But, 35 years ago when I did that story, it was sort of like, I was the crazy one. but now it's mainstream. Same thing with smoking. 1964, Surgeon General's report that smoking is hazardous to your health. We knew that then. Why were we still smoking on planes in 1995? But, right now I know that this change is happening. It's going to happen very quickly, and people are going to be wondering, why it took so long once we've done it. But if you're on the vanguard, you're used to being the odd one out. You know, it's certainly, you know, I'm comfortable with it. And, you know, right now people, you know, that eat meat say, well, what's this crazy guy on the radio talking about not eating meat? But I think in 15 years, 20 years from now, kids are going to be looking at, you know, eating meat like, you know, people smoking. It doesn't make any sense anymore that we should take animals and eat them for their protein when we can get it from plants. It's better for the environment, it's better for your personal health, and it's certainly better for the animals.
In the film, you mentioned the element of adventure. There's a lot of undercover investigative reporting that goes on, and there are also some victories that you get to celebrate in the film. There are also some incredibly bleak moments, and I want to play just another moment from the film.
This is a song recording of a male o'o singing on Kauai. These birds mate for life, so he would be singing a duet with his mate, where he sings and she sings back and forth. Here comes the male song. There's no response. Here's the male song again. That's the last male of a species singing for a female who will never come. He is totally alone. And now his voice is gone.
Another moment from the documentary Racing Extinction, directed by my guest, Luis Ojeyes. And Luis, I mean, a moment like that is so powerful and so moving. And it's not the only story of its kind that you share in the film. And you speak very movingly about the extinction of the Baha'i dolphin as well. With those tremendous losses that you are able to document, how do you maintain hope? We've lost so much already, and we're not going to be able to prevent all of those losses.
Well, like my friend Jane Goodall says in the film, there's so much left yet to protect. You know, in the course of making this film, you know, Indonesia, Sean Heinrichs, who is one of my, you know, he lives in Boulder, Colorado, like I do, and he's an ocean activist, and he, in the course of making this film, Indonesia was killing more manta rays. This is a, you know, the animal looks like a flying B-1 bomber underwater, but it's the most beautiful, graceful thing you've ever seen in your life when you see it underwater. Indonesia was killing more of those than any country in the world. And in the course of making this film, Sean almost single-handedly, you know, with help with a couple friends and a couple of other NGOs like ours, he helped turn Indonesia in a four-year period of time into the biggest marine sanctuary in the world for manta rays. This is, you know, one guy working with a couple friends. And so when people say that, you know, one person, who am I can't change the world, you know, you look to somebody like Sean Heinrichs, and, you know, there's that maximum by the anthropologist Margaret Mead. She says, never doubt that a few thoughtful citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. So in the course of making this film, you see these people that we follow, these heroes to me, and you see them changing the world. And it takes away this feeling, I think, that everybody has of like, oh, what can I do? There's so much, you know, negative going on in the world. But I look at the positive. You know, yeah, there's always going to be a disaster somewhere. But if you can keep on pushing that log up the hill and get your friends to help you, eventually you get up over the hump. And that's what we're doing with the film. It's about looking and, you know, celebrating, you know, the idea that we can change the world. You know, when I was made The Cove is about, you know, it's a covert mission to expose this town that's killing more dolphins than any place in the world. They were killing 23,000 dolphins every year in Japan, dolphins and porpoises. And then putting them into school systems where kids were eating them, the toxic meat for food. Well, that stopped. We stopped that being, you know, spread out into the school system, and now they're only killing 6,000. It's like a 70% drop in you know, the eating of dolphins and porpoises for human consumption in the 5 years since that film's been out. And we're not going to quit until it's done. But that one film that we did has had a, you know, great consequences for cetaceans in Japan. You know, we've saved tens of thousands of cetacean lives. So I can see that, you know, it's just a matter of getting enough people to see a film, getting enough people to understand and to feel. You know, people don't change behavior on what they think. The science shows they change behavior on what they feel. And then they use arguments to justify how they feel. So in this film, you know, the use of the OO, you know, that songbird that's the last male of the species, we bring that up early on because it starts to melt your heart. I mean, that's a science fiction nightmare. It's like, you know, it's like the movie of the guy alone on Mars. It's, you know, we can all imagine what it'd be like to be the last person alive in the middle of nowhere. But this is happening 30,000 times a year, people say, some scientists say, that, you know, species are blinking out about 1,000 times faster than the background rate of extinction in, you know, when you average it all over the world. So, yeah, we're losing species at this incredible rate, but now we have an opportunity to change things. And if you're only looking at the problems instead of the solutions, you're never going to get to where you need to get to.
Luis Cejuelas, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Academy Award-winning filmmaker Luis Cejuelas. His new documentary, Racing Extinction, will premiere worldwide on the Discovery Channel on December 2nd. He'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every student who goes to school in this day and age will be exposed to some kind of education about bullying and bullying prevention. The play Out of Bounds was created to help middle schoolers understand and deal with cyberbullying, but it was designed to stand out from the typical guidance education that students are used to. The play was commissioned by Hancher Auditorium and developed by Working Group Theater. A 40-minute version of the play has been performed in many schools around the state of Iowa. The tour will continue next week. There's also a full-length version of the play that includes the perspectives of adults involved in the lives of the kids in the play, and that'll be performed at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts on November 14th, and all of this will be followed by a national tour. And with me today is Sean Lewis, director of the play and co-founder and co-artistic director of Working Group Theater. Hello, Sean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also Jennifer Fawcett is with us, writer of the play and co-artistic director of Working Group Theater. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
Thank you both for being here today. And tell me about the genesis of this play. I know it was a couple of years ago now, but Sean, where did the idea come from?
Well, really, it was generated by Hancher Auditorium. They were part of this initiative with the Kennedy Center where they had found that there were there weren't really youth shows being created for audiences fifth through like ninth grade, which we found out why really early on when Jen started going out and doing interviews and talking to people about like, oh, we're going to create a show for fifth through ninth graders. Like people would just kind of laugh and be like, oh, good luck. You know, like
because they didn't want to pay attention to something like this. They didn't want to go to school assemblies. Is that?
I think you just nailed all of it.
Okay.
Yeah, there was just a level of like those kids, like kids that age are just naturally difficult because it's also that period of time. Like we went to some of the schools to do the interviews and I just remember this gym class that we watched and you were watching the kids run in circles, you know, like as you were forced to in gym class. And it was just so strange because you would see some people who like, you know, I remember there was these two boys running right next to each other. One of them like easily was like 6'4" and looked like a fully grown man. And his friend was literally like 5'6" and weighed like 55 pounds, you know, and you're just kind of like, this is such a weird, weird time in life. Like, no wonder you're like angsty and frustrated and just kind of like don't want to see a bunch of people coming in to do theater for you.
Right. Well, there's a lot going on at that age. And Jennifer, you went out to start doing interviews. And what was it that you started hearing that made you think, oh, we can make this work?
You know, it was so I was hearing a lot of the same stories from people. You know, there's this common theme with people who are dealing with bullying on the victim side who feel very isolated. And yet, you know, this is such a common problem. It's something that I experienced when I was a kid. Sean experienced it. A lot of our actors have experienced it. And yet you feel so alone when you're in the middle of it. And it's really hard to see past that. Like, is this ever going to end? And so hearing these stories, it just felt like, I think if we talk about these stories, if we tell these stories on stage, then there's going to be an opportunity for recognition and empathy. And kids who are at, you know, whether they're the victim or the bystander, I mean, most kids really are bystanders, or the bullies themselves can see that, you know, there's something on the other side of this that I need to try and get to. So the need for telling these stories on stage just became a lot stronger the more people we spoke to.
And once you started gathering the stories and thinking, okay, we are going to make this work, and getting to know kids in this age group, which is such a difficult time of life for most of us, I mean, what came into your mind as far as, okay, if we're going to make this work, we have to create something that is compelling enough and smart enough that these kids won't feel like they're being condescended to. These kids won't feel like they're just hearing the same thing that they've heard in guidance lessons since they were in kindergarten. I mean, how did you come up with a way to do that, Sean?
Well, I mean, I think Jen had the smart and the emotional down. I mean, she's such an excellent writer that, like, there was such a great journey and emotional take to it. I think I'm immature enough to be able to step into, like, like, I mean, I like comic books a lot still, and I like hip-hop music a lot still, and, like, I don't like to deal with how old I'm getting. So I think what I was useful for at times was stepping in and going, like, okay, I'm back in fifth grade, and I'm being forced to come to an assembly about the topic bullying. I'm like, immediately, I'm like, I think this is the worst thing ever, like, before anything started. So my directing response to it started to become that, of I'm like, okay, if I'm that kid, how do I engage with him right from the get-go? And some of the things that we did right away is, like, one thing I just started thinking was, like, oh, something that used to stymie me when I was a kid was when adults would, like, take my argument. Like, when they would acknowledge that they knew what I was thinking, I would suddenly be dumbfounded. So in the show,
you don't have anything else to say?
No, because I'm like, well, I think this is stupid. So if someone came out right away and they're like, we know that you might think this is stupid, I'm just like, you're listening to me? That's weird for me. I guess I have to be quiet for a moment. And so the actors come out and they basically do that right from the get-go. They're like, we know you were forced to come here. We know you might not like this. We know that bullying just sounds like a lame word to begin with. And it's amazing. The kids do suddenly go, like, you do kind of see a shift from, like, the rowdiness of the start of an assembly to, like, how do they know that I think this? This is very confusing to me. So it's kind of a little sleight of hand on the directing side of how to move that around. And then Jen just did such a great job, I think, of drawing out the actual stories that they start to literally see themselves on stage. So then they're like, oh, they kind of knew that I thought this was going to suck, and this is actually kind of about me. And they start to engage a bit more.
Well, Jen, give us in a nutshell. I know that you've done a version for middle schoolers, and you've also done a version for general audiences. But give us in a nutshell the story that is told in the play.
Yeah. So in the play, we have a new girl who's 14 years old. Her name is Amy, and her parents have just got divorced, and she's moved. She's gone to a new school. So, and she's starting in the middle of the year, which is like the worst thing ever. And she meets these two girls, one of whom is very warm and open to her. The other is a little standoffish. Amy is a little less feminine maybe than these other girls, not as developed or not as comfortable in her body. And so there starts to be questions about, oh, maybe she's kind of boyish. So off stage, we hear about a conversation that happened online where Amy was dared to send basically a very inappropriate picture of herself online, which she does over Snapchat, which is supposed to disappear. But the picture doesn't disappear. It gets there's a screenshot taken, and it gets passed around the school, and the bullying starts, and it just doesn't go away. It gets worse and worse and worse. And that was something that I was reading a lot about, and you read a lot about in the news. It just sort of catches on like wildfire, and suddenly it's just completely out of your control. So in the youth version, we keep it with the kids, and Amy ends up confronting these two girls who have started out kind of as friends and then have turned on her and really trying to stand up for herself. In the full-length version that is for families, we go into the adult world. And so then we start to see how Amy's mother and a principal and a local youth worker are also trying to grapple with this. With so much of it happening online, it's really this question of, you know, who is responsible for this? Who is policing this? How do we control this? How do we stop this? So we just sort of follow that struggle through multiple generations.
And we have just a little excerpt from a recording that was done of the play. This is from that full-length version. So this involves Amy talking to her mom, and I take it it occurs after she has skipped school for a day.
On Monday, Maddie followed me into the bathroom, and she told me to come out of the stall, but I didn't. I couldn't move. And she stayed there a really long time, and then she left, but she wrote on the mirror in marker, "You should die." And I was trying to rub it off, but this girl, Ling, comes in, and she just moved to the school in January, and she's from China or something, and she doesn't really know anybody, but she couldn't look at me. And then on Tuesday, I got a list of ways I could die in my locker. And I didn't want to see what they would do today.
That's just a moment from the play Out of Bounds. And Jen, in writing the play for students and for the general audience, you're showing the story of a situation that a lot of students can relate to, a lot of parents mm-hmm. can relate to as well. Now, often when kids get educated about bullying, you know, they get messages about, okay, how do you deal with it? How to identify it? What is the message that you're trying to give kids with this story?
It's a tricky question because, I mean, in a lot of ways, the message is similar in you're not alone and you need to turn to trusted allies who will help you stand up against this. And I don't think we're saying in that way anything different from what is being said through other anti-bullying initiatives. One thing that is different, though, is that through the play, kids are getting an opportunity to see the adults around them struggling with this as well. And the adults are getting a chance to see some of the politics, they're very, very complex politics that happen between young people. And so I think that allows for maybe a different kind of conversation to happen between young people and teachers or young people and their parents. We were really wanting to get into that complexity because everybody agrees bullying's wrong. Like, I don't think anyone thinks it's a good thing, but it doesn't go away and it lasts through generations. And so why is that? So I was trying to kind of dig into the why. You know, Amy does do something that is irresponsible. It's stupid. You know, what she does is not a good thing. So she's not a martyr. She makes a mistake. But the thought is, we all make mistakes. And how can we get past those mistakes? And how can we stand up for each other when those mistakes are made?
And Sean, I know you mentioned that you experienced bullying as a kid, and a lot of us did. And this story is not about you, but you have said that going through the process of working on the play and seeing kids react to it has actually given you more empathy for the bullies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, you know, I think if it was about me, there'd be like no perspective. Because invariably I'd be like, oh, this is my story? Well, those guys suck. Like, the people who picked on me are awful, and I hope bad things happen to them.
Right.
You know? That's just who I am, I guess. But it's interesting, like, having that remove. Jen has this amazing scene that she wrote that just kind of – I think it always hits and always hits the audience where you meet the parent of the bully. And the parent basically throws out a question of, like – is this completely random or not? Like, what happens if for a moment we stop and go like that's – and we kind of think like certain people are chosen for bullying? And it's this interesting idea. Like you don't necessarily agree with – I love the bravery of it, of that it's like – it's a divisive commentary to say, like, what happens if for a second we go, like, maybe the kid has done something? Like, what if we actually look for reasons as opposed to judgment? Like, when I was getting bullied as a kid, I would go home and I would tell my mom, and my mom would immediately just go, like, well, those kids are jealous of you. Which, like, at 36 years of age, like, I'm pretty certain those kids were not jealous of me. Like, I was overweight with a bad haircut. I don't think any of them were like, I only wish I was Sean Lewis. You know, so then I start going, like, well, what would have happened if I had gone home to my mom and we sat down? And not saying that, like people are so worried to take on responsibility, I think, all the time. So I'm like, not that maybe I did do something or maybe I didn't, but what if we just took on the possibility of all of that and said, like, well, what is causing the issue? What is the problem here? Because this has been a fascinating thing. Like, on my side too, as a producer, right, going out and doing fundraising, it's been the weirdest show in my entire life to try and raise money for, because my meetings all start the same. And I think it's generational. I'll sit down with people and I'll be like, we're doing a show about bullying. And invariably, my meetings will always go like, you know, I don't think bullying exists. I think kids just have to get over it. That's how it starts. And then, like, a half hour into the conversation with the same person, this has happened numerous times, they go, you know, I got picked on a lot as a kid too. And I'm like, wait, we started the conversation.
When you're saying that didn't happen.
It didn't exist at all. So it's just this interesting, like how we talk about it and how we learn about it is I think, so important. I think we've gotten just so used to weirdly accepting it. Like, everyone just kind of accepts, like, bullying happens in school. But now we see more and more examples of it in the workplace, and more examples of it in, you know, even like retirement homes, like, you'll read newspaper articles about. And you start going, like, well, it's an educational thing. Like, you kind of grow up learning, this is how I behave to other people. And it never got corrected. It was just always like, well, they're jealous of you, or that's just how things go. So it's like, well, what if we just start asking more of the questions, even the really hard ones that we don't want when we're feeling bad, from the get-go?
So having people watch this play and empathize with Amy, who's getting bullied, and Amy's mom, who's trying to help her daughter and feels so helpless, and maybe even empathizing with the other people who are involved, even the bullies, is there a solution, or is it just that awareness is helpful?
Is there a solution? Yeah. You want to take that one, Jen?
I mean, I think I believe there has to be a solution. I mean, bullying is cruelty. Why are we cruel to each other? I don't know. I mean, as an artist, I'm fascinated by this question. As a parent to be, I'm terrified by this question. but I have to believe that there can be a solution. I disagree. I mean, what Sean was saying is so true. And there are a lot of people who feel that it's a rite of passage. You know, you just have to learn that the world is tough and you got to toughen up, kid, or, you know, you're going to be in for it your whole life. But I talked to people who have been so scarred by this. Things that happened to them when they were a child, they carry as adults. They've carried it into relationships. They've carried it into their work life. They've lost jobs because of it. It's affected mental health. And there's studies that show that this can be the case. So I think that there has to be a solution, because I've also talked to a lot of people who have overcome. I talked to one woman who said, actually, I was a bully when I was a kid. And I'm really not proud of that. And
well, you're clearly starting a lot of conversations. And unfortunately, we're going to stop this one because we're out of time. But Jennifer Fawcett, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Sean Lewis, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Both from Working Group Theater. The play is called Out of Bounds. It's going on a tour around Iowa and then a national tour. And the longer version for general audiences will be performed at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts on November 14th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.